Well, welcome everybody. One person just dived out because they actually discovered that where they were wanting to be was in the seminar next door, not in this one. So this is the In Search of Good Energy Policy group, and welcome to the first time of the seminar this term. And in doing so, let me say thank you very much indeed to our speaker and respondent, because those of you who've been sort of following the paperwork will know that a different seminar was intended for today, but the speaker is ill. And thank you very much for our two for standing in at short notice for what I think is going to be a very, very interesting session. And I'll tell you in a minute why I particularly think it's going to be interesting. But let me move on. Rules of the game. One of the things that we manage extremely well in the group each time is we discuss things on the Chatham House rule. That is to say, you can quote things that emerge in the meeting, but you never allocate it to any particular person. So we're in kind of neutral terrain. And what we do aim for and achieve is very good, friendly discussions across many different aspects of subjects and so on, and different faculties and different abilities and so on. And we end up with lots of things to talk about afterwards, which is great. What we are always wanting to do as a group, and I'll come back to this in a moment, because I think this particular session highlights for me an important aspect, is we're trying to look at good, in quotes, good energy policy, but we know that that's a very complicated animal. How do we get hold of it? And in each session, what aspects of what we discussed today contribute to good or bad energy policy? What are the policy implications, not just locally in the UK, but in Europe, the world, etc., etc.? And what other ways of looking at things might be helpful? And between us, what other perspectives can we offer and share and draw on as a group? Today, our speaker, Rihan, is from the Department of Architecture. And if I just read, not off that one, off my, she's doing a PhD looking at evolving houses and evolving demand practices. It's a practice-based analysis of electricity consumption in middle-class houses in Pakistan. And her wider interests, or root interests, if you like, are social practice theory, energy consumption, and human-centered energy use. And Sheila, who will be commenting on that afterwards, is in the... let me find it.
Upstairs, second floor.
upstairs here, and she's the Tigris. She's one of the co-leaders, is that right, of the Tigris project, which is a research program to study how to improve crop productivity and water use, identify appropriate crops and farming practices for sustainable rural development, which is a global challenges funded project, quite a big project. And her wider interests are institutional reform and collective action, food production and rural development, gender norms and gender gaps in development interventions, and provision of public goods and the role of partnerships. So if you get a sense of the width of different aspects that need looking at, and in particular today, the subject we've got today, I'm going to be looking at these things, and I'll come back to that in a little bit more detail in a moment. But let me just follow on to the end of these slides. A couple of weeks' time, we'll be looking at past and prospective transitions in the UK gas industry. 2 weeks after that, contestation, contingency and justice in the Nordic low-carbon energy transition. And a couple of weeks after that, end of November, at looking at energy efficient cities. And the whole purpose of these seminars is to cross-link us all and get us talking together from our different perspectives about things. Do, at any point, have a word with Michael here, have a word with Shafiq was here, or anybody else, me, you know, anybody, of things that have caught your attention and are interesting and you would like us to chew on a bit more. You know, just because we have seminars on a Tuesday at lunchtime, that isn't the limit to the conversations that we're allowed to have. But there's a particular aspect, and it's about widening the scene, if you like, that I wanted to share with you before we set into today's seminar, because it particularly caught my attention, is of interest to me. One of the things I've had chance to read, and you haven't, is a paper that we have that has written with a PhD supervisor that's the basis for the work which is going to be shared in a minute. But let me just read you the abstract from the paper, because it brings up what for me are some of the key issues in this whole terrain that we're trying to grapple with. And you'll have to forgive me because the writing's small, the lighting isn't brilliant, so I'm kind of going to be hard to read. This paper, the paper I've got in my hand, seeks to address the gap in current studies of domestic energy use in countries in the global south from a socio-technical perspective. It explores a trajectory of domestic spatial layouts and accompanying household practices over the last century in Lahore, Pakistan. The researcher identifies various nexuses of practice spatial arrangements of urban housing that have emerged, persisted, and transformed over time, giving rise to unsustainable levels of electricity consumption in middle-class households. A mixed method approach was adopted for collecting data, including a review of archival documents, building regulations, house plans, case studies, oral history narratives, and expert interviews. The analysis reveals three key themes as central to explaining increasing household electricity demand: a shift from outdoor to indoor activities, transformation from inward to outward oriented design, and a spatial dispersion of practices. The study suggests that understanding longitudinal dynamics of practice arrangements can help identify and prevent normalization of unsustainable configurations that gradually become embedded in social structures and practices. Contemporary standards are likely to prefigure higher demands for electricity because of increased consumption and specification of spaces, culturally ill-suited indoor and outdoor configurations, unquestioned reliance on electricity, and neglected use of outdoor space. Though confined to a single case, this study has broadened, has broader methodological applicability and implications for other countries in the global south. Now, I'm not going to flip back on the slides, but if I flip back to our overall of good energy policy, what I've just talked about is evolving unintended consequences over a century that evolve so slowly that they're kind of invisible, but actually hugely formative of what happens. So what do you mean when you say policy? I mean, just who do you think you are? You know, how do you get the grip on this sort of stuff and articulate it and share it? Well, I will now shut up. And if Shafiq can flip the slides over, we'll let our presenter tell us the story in detail.
I hope this works. Okay, so thank you everyone for coming. and it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Michael and Shafiq, for giving me this opportunity. So, thank you, Jim, for the introduction. I'm not going to repeat some of the things that you've already said now. So this was this presentation is based on a paper that was recently published in Building an Environment by myself and my supervisor, Mina. Where's Mina? She's here. Okay, so let me start off with a background to energy demand in the Global South. Now, the building sector accounts for just over 30% of global energy consumption. And in the Global South, this consumption is expected to grow nearly three times the rate for the developed nations by 2040. Estimates show that by 2030, 80% of the middle class globally is going to be residing in the Global South, and it will be accountable for roughly 70% of energy consumption worldwide. So Pakistan is one such country in the Global South that has been facing increasing gaps between its energy supply and demand. It has been identified as among the top 10 countries most vulnerable to climate change. For the past 15 years or so, the common form of demand management in Pakistan has been electricity load shedding, where power is shut down intermittently for 6 to 8 hours in the urban areas and even longer in the rural sector. I like to show this image because I find it extremely interesting. So this is a satellite view of the city of Lahore taken in 2013. So you can actually tell where the load shedding was taking place. So all these patches, black patches, this is where the power outage was. So of course, this has had a huge impact on the country's GDP, but also on the daily lives of the Pakistani people. Before we go into designing and effectively coming up with demand management strategies, I think it's important to understand what this demand is for and how it has come about. So one way of looking at it is to think of energy consumption as an input that provides products or services. An alternative viewpoint is to think of energy consumption as an outcome of what people and organizations do. And this is the view that has been taken up by a number of social scientists. And I'll come back to that in a minute. Let me just briefly restate some of the objectives of this research. So this research took a socio-technical approach to the understanding of energy consumption in middle-class households in Pakistan by analyzing the co-evolution of the house spatial arrangements and the accompanying social practices. So instead of simply considering buildings as the grounds for technological efficiency and improvements in building fabrics, there is a need to think of buildings as the material counterparts for competing social practices. And this is the view which is now presented by social practice theory. So what is social practice theory? Can I just see by a show of hands who has actually heard of social practice theory before? Okay, some people have. Okay, that's good. So social practice theory is a way of looking at the world. It's a cultural framework that takes a middle ground between individualism and collectivism by focusing on practices as the basic unit of analysis. So instead of focusing on the individual and his rational choices or the collective normative structures, what this theory tells us to do is to take practices, that is the doings and sayings of people, as the basic unit and the site of social. Now, I won't go into the details of this theory because that would take me another presentation. Let me just briefly say that, so one of its pioneers, Shatzi, has presented his framework of practice arrangements, according to which all of social order is formed of the bundling of social practices and material arrangements. Material arrangements here mean materiality in all its shapes and forms. So things, objects, infrastructures, to the human body itself. And this is the framework that I've adopted in my own analysis. So I use a mixed method approach using both qualitative and quantitative modes of data collection. These included oral history narratives, interviews with homeowners, as well as professional experts, case studies of houses from various architectural periods in Lahore, as well as the analysis of archival documents, building regulations, house plans, etc. Okay, so I want to start off by taking you through a journey of how the house spaces have evolved over the last century in Lahore. So we are actually going to start off a bit earlier, in the 19th century, in the old part of Lahore, which is known as the Walled City. Now, housing and development in the Walled City had followed much the same pattern of development that had prevailed in the Indian subcontinent for centuries. So the traditional houses, the larger of these, were called the Havelis, which were the central courtyard houses, with the outer walls marking the boundary lines of the plot and expanding out organically to fill up the available spaces in a maze-like urban fabric. Now, Islamic domestic architecture can best be described as introverted, conceived from the inside outwards, with distinct layers of private and public life, which are expressed through the architecture. So, the courtyard, which was the focal point of the house, was the most private space and so most conducive to female practices, basically all household chores. So this included the cooking, eating, washing and bathing, sleeping and relaxation. Basically everything was being done in the courtyard. This was then surrounded by a number of rooms which were used interchangeably for various functions throughout the day and throughout the various seasons. Including storage, a pantry for the kitchen, for sitting, relaxation, etc., as a semi-private zone. And this was then connected to an outer peripheral zone, which contained a betak, which is a sitting room, or a second courtyard, which would open onto the street and would be used to host male gatherings as a form of an extension of the public space. Now, under the colonial occupation in the late 19th century, the ruling British class developed their own separate housing communities, such as the Civil Lines and the British Cantonment. During this time, the use of rooms had changed drastically in Britain, and so this gave rise to new meanings and ideals of housing and appropriate health and hygiene in the British houses, which resulted in the emergence of a new housing typology called the British bungalow. Now, bungalow houses reversed the configuration of the house. So now, the built area was surrounded by the large outdoor spaces. Bungalow housing was defined by its biaxial symmetry, the separation of different activities into distinct spaces within the house, as well as the introduction of verandas and central passageways for proper air circulation. Most significant was the absence of a centrally enclosed courtyard space. Outdoor activities like cooking were still being performed outdoors, just not by the homeowners themselves. So the kitchen and a servant quarter were now separated from the main building to maintain distance between the colonizer and the colonized. New distinct spaces like designated dining rooms, study areas, and office spaces had also been introduced to the local architectural vocabulary. Now, as it so happens in a lot of these colonized spaces, it wasn't long before the local affluent residents had started imitating the colonial spaces in their own new housing societies. And a very good example of this was seen in the Model Town Society, which was based on Ebenezer Howard's concept of the Garden City. So houses that were built during this era, from the 1920s onwards, they represented an architectonic merger, resulting in a hybridized bungalow, where the front reflected colonial ideologies, while the back remained traditional in use. So, as you can see, the kitchen had now spun around and attached back to the main building. The dining room had been taken backwards for closer proximity. And most importantly, the backyard had now replaced the central courtyard as the center of household activity. Now, after the independence of Pakistan in 1947, many new planned housing schemes were developed under the new local authorities. But because of the massive population expansions and increasing land values, the building regulations gradually changed over time. And there were two major changes that took place. The first was that the plot sizes gradually reduced, but at the same time, the maximum permissible covered area within the plot increased. And so the result was that the houses that were built from the 1950s onwards, you can actually see that these, the verandas and the backyards, they are now shrinking in size. The verandas and the central passageways, which were an important element of passive design in houses, are still there. But this was soon to change as well. This time, because of another major player, technological advancements. So houses built from the 70s onwards saw two major technological changes take place. The first was the introduction of televisions in the 1960s, which completely changed the focus of evening entertainment and relaxation activities. But it wasn't until the advent of mechanical ventilation and cooling that the spatial configuration completely evolved. So as you can see, the verandas and the central passageways now completely disappeared, and a new central space had emerged, the TV lounge. And the backyard, which had been shrinking, now became less and less functional, and this was now the center of activity. Also, the built area now dominated the unbuilt. Now, since the turn of the century, Lahore has been expanding rapidly. And from then onwards till the present, it has simply been a matter of progressively increased dependency on mechanical means, not just for comfort, but for almost all household practices. So contemporary houses that are built today are based on a condensed, deep, open plan configuration with large glass windows that conform more to the Western modernism and post-modernism, that rely on maximized covered areas and minimal outdoor spaces. This is the narrow band of outdoor spaces left. And what has this done in terms of our energy consumption? So what we find through this analysis is that over the last century, there have been three key processes of change in household practice arrangements that have basically resulted in increasing household energy consumption. So the first of these is a shift from more outdoor to indoor activities. Now, in the old traditional houses, the open spaces like the courtyards were extensions of the house, merging the indoors with the outdoors and the natural and the physical with the natural environment. And this continued to be so when the backyards replaced the courtyards in the bungalow houses. But then gradually, with the changes in the building regulations, the outdoor spaces became less and less functional. And then finally, with the complete reliance on technology, all the activities were basically forced to shift indoors. Now, the electric power system has been one of the greatest mediators of social change as a cultural artifact. If we look at the electric appliance ownership statistics for Punjab, which is the province where Lahore is based, we find that from the 1990s onwards, there has of course been a rising trend for technology, which is indicative of the changing materiality in the performance of various household practices. So what's happening is not only are practices being shifted indoors, but their spatial and their temporal dimensions are also changing under the changing rhythms of daily life. And this came out when talking to some of the older residents. So one of them, Samina, mentioned, "When I was young, we would sleep early and wake up early for Fajr. That's the morning prayer. It wasn't like nowadays when people don't go to sleep till 11 p.m. and don't wake up before 11 a.m. the next morning. Nowadays, people just sit around watching TV all day." So these technological changes, together with the blind following of the westernized modern spatial configurations, have gradually resulted in removing the outdoor activities and the spaces that accommodated them. So contemporary houses today are functional so long as they are reliant on the mechanical systems of ventilation and cooling. So much so that today, 47% of the total household electricity consumption goes into space cooling in some shape or form. So the next important shift has been from an inwards to an outwards oriented design. So as I mentioned earlier, traditional havelis were designed to be introverted with layers of private and public spaces. The colonially inspired building regulations have had a profound effect on the privacy of outdoor spaces. So when houses came closer together because of the changing bylaws, and also there were restrictions on the maximum heights of the boundary walls, outdoor spaces no longer provided the necessary privacy for females to carry out their day-to-day chores. And so most household chores were taken indoors, which meant greater reliance on ventilation, cooling, and even lighting. But why lighting, you would think? Why lighting in the daytime? So that's where it gets interesting. Because by conforming to the Western modernistic designs of these open plan spaces with large glass windows, often what happens is that these indoor spaces also don't provide the necessary privacy and segregation that is required by females for their day-to-day chores. And this is something that quite a few females mentioned during the interview. So for example, Ghazal mentioned, "I want to have my privacy when I'm in my bedroom. I like that the curtains remain drawn always. I don't feel comfortable if neighbors and house staff can see inside." So what's happening is to maintain the privacy of indoor spaces, women find it more comfortable to have the curtains drawn and rely on artificial lighting even in the daytime. Okay, and then the last factor has been a shift, a spatial dispersion of practices. Now, traditionally, spaces were designed to be multifunctional and polyvalent, promoting more collective practices. But as we saw in the colonial bungalows, spaces were becoming more and more distinct in their functions, in their use, with the introduction of designated study areas and dining rooms. And this was further enhanced by the type of furnishings that were gradually becoming more trendy and fashionable. So instead of the very lightweight, portable furniture that was used traditionally, such as the wooden platforms or the charpais, which are these string beds, they were now being replaced by heavy, stylized, decorative furniture. So for example, in the case of the charpai, that was replaced by the wooden framed single beds. And then by the 70s, the double beds had become available in the market, which basically meant that spaces were now fixated for specific functions. So this is the result of our increased material dependency under the rise of consumerism. But what's interesting is that, so this isn't a phenomena which is confined to the Global South. This is something which we see everywhere in the world. Statistics actually show that in the last 30 years in the US and in Europe, although the household size has reduced, the cupboard area or the living space per person has actually increased, which has more or less offset any of the efficiency reductions that were achieved. So, but the thing is, it's not just our material dependency which is at fault. There's also a shift in our sociocultural norms from more collective to more individualized practices. For example, where before there used to be a single television for the whole household, and it used to be watched by everyone in one space. Over time, now you see that there are at least two or three different television sets in two or three different living rooms in houses, which are being watched separately by the three different generations that are living within the house because of their preference for separate TV programs. And also, again, with some of the older residents, they mentioned back then it wasn't the norm to have a lot of rooms, to have separate bedrooms for everyone. Everyone used to sleep and live together. This is quite a recent trend. Now everyone demands a separate bedroom for so-called privacy. Okay, so what are the main conclusions? Now, household energy consumption, according to this research, shows that it is embedded within the material as well as the social structures that are mutually dependent, co-evolve, and hence require a joint analysis to really get a grip on what energy consumption is for realistic demand reductions and for us to start moving towards more sustainable pathways of intervention. Technology is important, no doubt, but what this analysis shows is that it shows us how and why Energy, domestic energy consumption continues to increase in the Global South despite improvements in the technology of appliances and despite improvements in the building fabric. So assigning technology complete agentive power is misleading, because this is where we lose some of the important connections that it has with the sociocultural norms, with the standards that we have set for ourselves in society today. Context is extremely important. A blind following of the Western demand management policies and solutions in architecture and aesthetics have resulted in conflicts with the day-to-day practices. These modernistic models with the open plan spaces and large glass windows, they are not only climatically and culturally ill-suited, but are also not conducive to the daily practices and are inherently more energy intensive. Finally, for Lahore, more sustainable practice material arrangements, such as introverted houses with multifunctional spaces, with perhaps a better merger of indoors with the outdoors, needs to be incorporated with more sustainable practices. For example, maybe we can have more outdoor-based entertainment activities or greater reliance on passive comfort. But let's see. Okay, so just a quick look at some of the policy implications. Now, understanding the longitudinal dynamics of practice arrangements helps us to recognize and prevent the normalization of certain standards that have come to define the perfect home or the ideal home. And we start to really realize how these standards have become embedded and ingrained in our society, in the infrastructure and the institutional systems over time. House planning and development needs to perhaps be better integrated with behavior change policies or energy demand policies, because otherwise they end up contradicting each other, as they have done in certain instances in the domestic sector in Pakistan. So perhaps a better integration of housing and energy policies can help us arrive at solutions that are not only climatically and environmentally more aligned, but also more relevant to the sociocultural context. And finally, the three themes that have been identified through this research can perhaps act as a starting point for targeting more vital issues, like how are spaces designed, perceived, and used, instead of simply focusing on technological and material efficiency. So I'd like to end here with these thought-provoking words from the social scientist Thomas Guy Wren, who said, "The play of agency and structure happens as we build. We mold buildings, they mold us. We mold them anew." Thank you.
Brilliant, thank you indeed. Would you like to flip the computer over? Sheila, comment on that.
I'll leave this up.
I thought we were going to sit and comment. Do I comment and then she comes and speaks? Yeah. Or is that how it's going to work?
Yeah. Okay.
Right. Drop the water. So thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to read the paper, Rifat. It was really enjoyable. And first, can I congratulate you for what must have been very challenging, but was a very effortless presentation. So I know how much hard work goes into doing multidisciplinary work and make it seem so effortless. So particular congratulations for that. And also the way that you took us over a number of generations in a household. Those of you who haven't read the paper, I strongly recommend. Seven generations in a household in a Haveli was, it was almost cinematically, you know, elegant. You could have made a movie about it, I thought. So the pictures were also much appreciated. As someone from the harder social sciences, you do numbers or we do qualitative, but pictures are much appreciated as well. As I read the paper, of course, I had a number of thoughts that were some directly related to the paper and some a little more errant, which are thoughts coming from my own disciplinary background. So I'll indulge in those in the second part. But in the first part, may I just make a couple of comments, and I'm aware the organisers want us to look at three main questions. So in relation to those three questions, my comments will also follow in that guise. So the first thing I was thinking about was, and this comes from my ignorance, you know, housing and energy. And I really enjoyed that distinction between energy as an input and energy as an outcome. And it fits in very nicely with the human development paradigm, where we've moved, as has DFID and other donor agencies, from looking at just impact to looking at outcomes, or what historians would call process. And what I really enjoyed in your paper, and what I'd like to push you on a little bit more, is in this process itself, this historical process that you have painted so beautifully for us, that interaction between colonial and colonized, using Chris Bailey, the historian, the previous Wilhelmont Bond professor's idea of hybridity. And I was wondering, and again, it's ignorance, is that a concept that maybe is useful? So you talk about change, but was there any benefit in that process of, you know, engaging, for example, did the post-colonial bungalow benefit at all? If there's some pictorial evidence it might have done. And so this dislocation is not the only thing that occurs between colonial and colonized. I would like to know a little about that. And I think that for me was particularly interesting, because that allows me then to take the discussion more generally to infrastructure and the energy component. So if I use housing as the context and then ask some questions about implications for good or otherwise energy policy, is it the case that disjunctures in housing, as you presented it, even if they're not hybridities, was also a consequence for the disjuncture in the provision of energy? Well, that's the question I've got. And so I ask it in the following way. Given the huge amount of informality in cities in Lahore, but global south more generally, is it the case, because we move in this lovely narrative from thinking of the Wahhabeli as a community of people where people came and went and gave their services, and so it was a sort of microcosm, and you thought of energy being provided, and I recall in particularly in terms of cooling, because you talk so much about air conditioners in your paper, about the traditional Islamic principles of allowing air to flow through. So many parts of Afghanistan at 52 degrees are way cooler inside than a typical building made out of concrete. So just thinking about, did we lose something there in terms of traditional modes of thinking, which then maybe didn't transfer into the British bungalow and certainly didn't transfer into the 21st century buildings in Lahore. So something there about whether disjunctures, the colonial transfer and housing, also could tell us something about a loss of knowledge. So that's my first narration. How long do I have? Because I don't want to turn into a mini lecture.
10 minutes,
okay. So the danger of me, this is the room I normally lecture in, so the danger of converting this into a 50-minute session, so I must remind myself not to be naughty. Okay, so that was the first set of the broad sweep that you gave us really drove that. In terms of your specific findings, and here I turn to thinking about my own work, which is in the bottom half, so I look at the bottom 50% in societies, and so I tend to look at off-grid when we're using the language of energy. I was curious about whether, and without being political, but just to use the word of inequality in energy demand, whether the way you showed that very powerful picture of, you know, 6 to 8 hours of load shedding in urban areas, if I had taken that picture down to the various kasbas in Lahore, the various sub-districts, would I have seen longer? Of course, I would have seen longer load shedding, and probably... maybe load shedding is not the right word for the informal sector. If I'm thinking of something like, you know, colonies where people are not formally registered, then I'm trying to think about this huge demand of air conditioning and other things. And so does it not create an emulation, a kind of keeping up with the Joneses effect, that people in the informal sector also don't just want the television, but may next from the cooler want the air conditioner? So is there not something here that you could tell us, which is unfair because it's outside your thesis, but I was just very curious about the key lessons you're telling us here also have a value, I think, for lessons we might learn if we're working from the informal sector. So I'm wondering, here's the question. The recycling of electric components, and particularly of things like air coolers and air conditioners, which are recycled extensively in South Asia, do we see that every time the upscaling happens in the middle class, that there is an increased sale of last year or last, I don't know, decades air conditioners in the other market? Is there an increase in the recycling of energy? And this could be positively good as distinct from e-waste. So that's what I want to know from your particular findings. And I don't know. For example, a direct way would be, do the domestic staff in these houses get first picks on old air coolers and air conditioners? I just want to know about the informal market in relation to that. And if I went to the third point, and that's sort of more generally learnings from this, I learned so many things. I mean, I know a little bit about housing, very little, but more as housing as human development. But what I was particularly struck, and here, if I may, this is partly my own commentary on what I work, which is gender relations. I asked a question which is around the way in which spatiality is changing and how this affects female labor participation. And I say this because recently there has been a set of investigations that goes across the globe. And so in a sense, the question is relating to what are the global things we can learn from this. So as women regard it as more difficult to manage the outside space, and this is from a number of social norms. Let me take an example which is not from South Asia, so we can generalize. So the country that's the most extreme in the point that I'm going to make is South Korea. It has the highest number of women graduates in the STEM subjects as a percentage of total graduates in STEM subjects. But it has, in comparison to that, a huge gender gap in relation to women in employment in the long term. So you will get a number, percentage of women entering, there's a gap there. But if you go 5 years down, the gap is very, very large. Okay. South Asia has, and for those of you who are not sort of gender gap nerds like me, South Asia is better in STEM than US, for example. So in South Asia and India, it's 40%. In Pakistan, it's in the high 30s. But in the United States, it's 21%. So there are some areas where you can see it. The puzzle I want to ask you is the following, and I want to think about this, is, as you get these gaps, is it the way of modern life the housing represents that's making it so difficult? You know, there's the home is a place you turn away and you've got to go long distances to do a number of things. And is there a way to reconsider then not just the house, but the locality itself, where you could think about new ways of housing and new ways of use, which go back to the epistemic idea of the Haveli, a community, but for a modern aspect. So those are my three. So you can see you've made me think a lot. I don't normally come up with big words like epistemic, so you've helped me a lot. And so over to you, and thank you so much for the paper.